people would tell me I'm waking up sweating at night because I'm not sure if the data that I'm presenting tomorrow is right or not, yeah. right? There are strong emotions related to that. And in 2016, actually, like Netflix was down for 45 minutes mm-hmm. because of wrong data.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Data Scientist Show. Today, we have Bar Moses. Bar is the CEO and co-founder of Monte Carlo, a data reliability company and creator of the data observability category. Earlier in her career, she was a management consultant at Bain & Company and a research assistant at the statistics department at Stanford University. Later, she became VP of customer operations at a customer success company, Gaininsight, where she helped scale the company 10x in revenue and build a data and analytics team. She also served in the Israeli Air Force as a commander of an intelligence data analyst unit. Bar graduated from Stanford with a bachelor's degree in mathematical and computational science. Today, we'll talk about Bar's career journey, data reliability and observability, and what it means for data teams. If you find the show helpful, subscribe to the channel, give me a 5-star review, and leave a comment. Welcome to the show, Bar.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks for the kind introduction.
Yeah, so how did you first get into data science?
Oh, great question. You know, actually, kind of start from the very top. I was born and raised in Israel, and actually grew up in a place called the Weizmann Institute of Science. So my dad is a physics professor, and I actually grew up, in his lab. Mm. Try not to blow things up too much, and kind of doing all various experiments, and kind of worked, or was exposed to science and scientific ideas and thoughts from a very early stage. Mm-hmm. My mom, in contrast, is actually like a meditation teacher and
really?
Dancer. Yeah, so kind of had sort of both views growing up, really fun. And then later on in my career, I think this was, I don't think we really called it data science back in the day, but we worked with data to inform decision making. That mm-hmm. was really kind of the start of it. And that was really during my work in the Israeli Air Force when I was drafted. I was drafted to the Israeli Air Force very young. I was 18 years old. Mm-hmm. I was a commander at 18 and a half and had, sort of a team of folks who were all 18 years old.
Yeah.
We didn't have years of training or experience to do what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And yet we had to work with data to serve operational units in the field to empower them to make decisions. Oftentimes, under stress or under very tight timelines. And so you can imagine in those scenarios how critical it is to get the data right.
Yeah.
And obviously had very different tools. This is like 15 years ago, almost 20 years ago, mm-hmm. had very different tools and frameworks to actually use data. And so those were sort of, I would say my learnings were sort of twofold. First is how critical reliable data is when you're making decisions that are, pertaining to human lives or to strategic decisions or anything like that. Actually, the data that you're using is the basis to all of those decisions.
Mm.
And then the second thing that I learned, kind of leading a group of people on a mission, that's very important and how to kind of motivate folks to come together and work together, build that camaraderie and, really sort of accomplish extraordinary things as a motivated group together.
Mm, that's such an interesting experience. I definitely want to talk more about data quality and observability later. So after this experience, you enrolled in Stanford and studied math and statistics. Can you tell us more about that experience?
Yeah, of course. So, I never actually visited California, I think, before I came over to Stanford. And I loved it. I really loved the experience. I loved my time there. Got to know some lifelong friends that I'm still in touch with today.
Yeah.
And, had the pleasure of really sort of learning various concepts and classes that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned my dad is a physics professor. And so I was sure I was going to go into academia. I actually spent some time at the statistics department as well, working there. And actually, that was kind of like my big sort of fail my dad moment when I realized that, I'm not going to go into academia. I really was, very grateful for my time there, but that it also helped me understand that, I'd like to sort of expand my horizon into business, actually, and learn a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And a lot of kind of folks and different people were actually going into consulting. And so there was something about consulting. I later joined Bain that was really appealing for a couple of reasons. One, there's sort of a variety of experiences. So, you know, I worked on cases that ranges from, you know, M&A, where you have to sort of really evaluate a particular target for acquisition, to, you know, how to help a retail company like a burger chain sell more burgers, to like a restaurant redesign, to working with a semiconductor company on how to optimize their manufacturing operations. And so the variety of sort of industries that I could get exposure to was really interesting to me. And the second part, which was really exciting, was how do you actually make informed decisions with very little data? Because the reality is, as a consultant, you don't really know the ins and outs of the business. And yet you have, you know, anywhere between 3 weeks to 3 months to make a recommendation on what direction should the company or the function take.
Yeah.
And yet you still need to make those decisions with very limited or often like wrong data or partial data that you just received. And so kind of learning from folks who've done this for many years, how to actually think in that situation was really exciting. And then I would say the third thing is the people. Like, there were just amazing people with me in my class and kind of along the journey who I learned a ton from.
Yeah. And you mentioned something very interesting. Sometimes you don't have the correct data or just partial data could be wrong, and you learn the framework of how to use those data to make decisions. So can you share some frameworks you use, or what are some questions you ask the business to come to the conclusion to make the decision?
Yeah, for sure. So one of, you know, the most interesting things that I've learned is data can tell whatever story you want.
Yeah.
So if you take like a piece, you know, a file with any kind of data, you know, some analysis, you can literally come to the conclusion that it's yes and the conclusion that it's no.
Right.
You can come to the conclusion that it's 10 or that it's 20. And you really, you know, for better or worse, I learned that you can use data to shape a particular narrative that you'd like. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes people have the narrative in their head already, and it's based on some gut or intuition. By the way, someone who did a lot of really interesting work on this is Daniel Kahneman, and in his book,
Thinking Fast and Slow.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is like, people already have some sort of gut and intuition, and they use the data to back that up. It's not the other way around. People say, oh, let's look at the data for answers. Yeah. Often it's actually like the data will help augment the answers. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, you know, the first thing that I learned on, you know, sort of the duality in the power of data to inform our narratives.
Yeah.
And then, you know, also being aware of that bias, right? And being aware that, you know, you could actually use data to tell two different stories. Mm-hmm. But I think that's also a powerful message, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, I do believe there's a lot of importance for automation, but data is not here to replace human judgment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of kind of frameworks that have helped, I think some of the things, you know, especially for, you know, if it's like an organization early, I think there's nothing that really can replace sort of real in the trenches, in the field experience. Mm. And so, for example, you know, I think even today in our decision making, actually speaking with a real customer, just one or two or 10, and hearing their stories and their experience gives so much of that, you know, qualitative color that is so important to add to the data and the analysis, and always remembering to come back to like, what does the customer really say and really want here?
Yeah.
I think without that, oftentimes like the data, you know, you can really make whatever you want of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Remember Jeff Bezos has a quote, if your data doesn't match the anecdote. I don't remember the exact quote. If your data metric doesn't match the anecdote, usually the anecdote is always trust the anecdote, the story. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, there's another quote that I love. It's I think it's something like, if we have the data, let's use the data. Mm. You know, if all we have is opinions, let's go with mine.
Yeah.
Right. Like I always think that's funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also if one customer has the frustration, probably there are 10 other customers has the frustration. So that's something real. But sometimes when you collect data, it goes through different layers, interpretation, metrics, sometimes you lose the information. And later you become VP of operations at Gaininsight. You build and scale global teams, including customer data analytics, customer success, business operation, etc. So how did you evaluate the success of data teams? So for example, do you want them to create more dashboards, reports? You know, do you measure by how many pieces of insights they generated or something else?
Great question. So, you know, after several years at consulting and sort of being, you know, the person who recommends, you know, a potential path using data to substantiate that argument, I really wanted to kind of move into, you know, being in the arena myself and actually being the person making that decision. And so one of the things that was really exciting to me about joining Gaininsight is that Gaininsight was creating a category from scratch.
Yeah.
Like there was, you know, nothing before, and then there was a new category called customer success. And the idea of customer success is really interesting by itself because, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the way in which businesses did business was really relationship driven. So like, hey, I'll take you out to dinner and let's go talk and be friends and then we can do business together. And the way that people thought about how to expand businesses and expand relationships was also very, very qualitative and very based on, you know, how do we think this customer is feeling? How do we think they are, you know, enjoying our product or not? And really not data driven. And with the creation of customer success, there was also a really strong effort to strengthen those and back that up with data. So what could I do today? I could start actually analyzing what does the data tell me about the happiness or the value or the ROI of my customer. So I'll just give you an example. You know, the most obvious is to look at product metrics, right? Like how often is the customer using the product?
Right.
But then there's some data that you maybe not have thought about that could tell you a different story about that customer. Like, for example, the number of support tickets that a particular customer is using. So the initial analysis, this is just, you know, kind of an anecdote, was that, you know, you might think that, you know, a particular how the customer engages with the support team tells you about, you know, the level of engagement and value. And obviously, you know, if there's like so many tickets, there's maybe, I don't know, like tens of tickets a day per customer, that probably means that this customer is struggling and needs help, right? But that's not the only sign of distress. What if there's no tickets at all? That actually might mean a sign of disengagement. So someone who's totally not working with your product. So what is the right number of tickets per day per customer that indicates a healthy customer? And what tells us that the customer is not in a good shape? And how do we use that across every single function? We can learn from the behavior, you know, to sort of find leading indicators of health and leading indicators of a customer that would want to expand and renew and a customer that actually is asking for help. In a way. And so, you know, during my time at Gaininsight, I basically had the pleasure of kind of, you know, working with various people and building different teams, all of them in go-to-market, including the data team. And we were responsible for dashboards and helping both our internal executives, our board members, to make decisions about the business. Like, for example, you know, this product is, you know, customers are using it and there's like very high adoption, and then this product isn't as much, and then you know, this marketing campaign is performing and this isn't, and then also surfacing data for our customers. So our customers were using reports that we were creating to understand their usage of Gaininsight. And you know, there were kind of various learnings from that time. First, it was my first experience in kind of, you know, building a startup. And I love that. It was super hard. There's a, you know, it's incredibly hard to start a company, let alone start a category. You know, it's really tremendous to see how far the customer success category has come. But second, really experience what it's like to be the person who is accountable for data that people are actually using on a daily basis. Now, this was in 2015, 2016. I think organizations have been saying we are data driven for a long time, but it's really in the last 5 to 10 years that we're actually using data. And I remember these were the first years where we're like, oh, we have data about our business, let's start using it. And that obviously sort of created a whole chain of events, but I think that was a tipping point when people really, really started using data to inform their work.
Yeah. And I like the example you mentioned, how many customer support ticket is a good amount. So for example, when you try to interpret those stories, when you try to understand and communicate with the customer or the business, a lot of times you don't know what is right. So how do you iterate the interpretation of the metrics and arrive at the correct answer?
Oh, great question. If you know the answer, then let me know. I don't think anyone knows, yeah, you know, how to, yeah, solve that. But I can tell you some mistakes that I've made that I've learned from. Maybe the first mistake is to like think that you can get the answer by like studying it deeply for a really long time. You know, it's like, if only I analyze the data a little bit more and like sit on this in my room and like stare at it, the answer will just come. No, like that's not how it works. Actually, like coming up with sort of an initial model as fast as possible and testing it in the field and getting feedback from real customers. So for example, let's say, you know, you put together a hypothesis that there's some threshold, like let's say 2 tickets or less, it's really bad. Between 2 to 10 is great, and 10 or more is also bad, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some distribution. And so the first thing you should do is like go to a customer and like ask, like, does this resonate with you? Like, am I crazy? Is this, you know, tell me a little bit about this. And then maybe talking to customers from each of those groups, right? The disengage and the engage groups, and sort of testing that out. And so as soon as possible, can you get into the hands of real customers? Like, they're sort of like get out of the building and actually test it. The more informed your model, the better your model will be. I think that's sort of one, you know, maybe my biggest learning in how to get this right, so to speak. But also recognizing that it's actually less about getting it right. And it's, you know, there's like the academic idea of, can I get something perfect? When actually in reality, like, people are not perfect and businesses are not perfect, but making progress and improving, you know, if the outcome of that exercise is that you identified, you know, 100 customers that were struggling and you move them from like the red zone to the yellow zone to the green zone, that's a huge win, right? Yeah. And so maybe, you know, your analysis wasn't perfect and your thresholds were not perfect, but you actually like made a difference and made more customers happy using that. That's huge, right? Like, I'll take that any day over like the alternative.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So a lot of data analysis, the how to measure the success of it, it's very ambiguous. And sometimes I'll have experiences discover something else and you try to solve a customer problem. That's a win. And also, I've definitely been there looking at the data myself, try to doing some very advanced modeling stuff. And I think that will make the analysis better. But I wish I could have go out there, have a meeting with a customer to get their feedback. And I think sometimes we have the fear, oh, what if we show a half-baked result? Are they gonna think I'm not like professional? But I think the quicker you get your results out there, you know, the more valuable input you're gonna get back, which is something you won't be able to get, you know, from just your spreadsheet.
Totally agree with you. I have a hypothesis that like everyone inside is like a recovering perfectionist, and we all like don't want to screw it up. And so we sit on it so much until we think it's perfect. And I think, you know, you definitely, there's a balance to it, right? It's definitely, you're right. Like, you don't want to put something in front of a customer that's not going to be helpful to them or not represent you well, right? I think that makes sense. But also there's a saying, like, if you're not shipping something that you're not embarrassed by, then you're kind of shipping too late. I think the most important thing is about, you know, being frank and honest about that. So you can go to a customer and say like, hey, this is actually like not done. It's very early thinking. It's very likely wrong in many areas. What I'd love your help on is focusing and narrowing in on what are the things to fix or what are the things that are important to get right. And I think once you're like vulnerable and open about that, like everyone knows that like, you know, there can be issues and, you know, obviously these things are hard, right? I'll just give an example from our world, actually. So, you know, we spend a lot of time, we'll get into this later, but Monte Carlo, we spend a lot of time on making sure that the data that we are surfacing to our customers is actually valuable. And part of it is actually like getting the model right. So making sure that, you know, there's a very low percentage of alerts that are actually like false positives or not meaningful to customers. But over time, what we've learned is that there are additional ways to make data valuable to customers, which is actually understanding which data is owned by which team. So for example, let's say, you know, a specific person owns the marketing data. They don't care about anything that's related to the financial data. That actually has nothing to do with how we're analyzing the data or modeling it. It has to do with the organization of that business and that process and how the people are working. And that is a learning that we would never have if we didn't actually talk to customers and actually take, you know, kind of take it to the next level and really understand what it means to make this data relevant to this person.
Mm. Yeah. So while you're working there, what are some struggles you identified in the data and analytics team?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned, this was back in 2016, 2015. Organizations, by and large, were starting to use data more. We were using data more internally, externally. And I remember, you know, waking up basically every Monday morning to like a barrage of emails and pings. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, no Slack back then, just saying like WTF, like why is data wrong?
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'm seeing this report, the numbers don't make sense here. There's no way that this can be right. What happened? Or worst, it's like Friday, 5 p.m., right when you're like heading home, or like Monday, 6 a.m. before a board meeting. That's exactly when someone's like, hey, why are the numbers wrong? And you're like, oh, I have no idea. right? Like that was my reality, me and my team. That was our life. And then the harder thing about it was once someone said, you know, someone downstream identified, like one of our stakeholders identified the data is wrong, you know, first of all, it's kind of like embarrassing. Like you want to, you know, you own the data. You want to be the person identifying that the data is wrong. So not only are you sort of the last person to learn about it, but also the process of understanding why would the data was wrong was so, so manual and cumbersome. So, you know, let's say someone, you know, identified a problem in the Looker report, we had to, and I'm sure, you know, this is kind of familiar for folks in the audience. When someone, you know, says that there's a problem, you have to start like unpacking the whole thing, the whole chain, understand where is it? Like, is it, you know, the report that's wrong? The like a table, the table, maybe the data is not fresh. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then like going upstream, maybe someone made a change somewhere, didn't let me know. Yeah. Maybe some third party data just didn't arrive. And you know, there's so many, there's like 100 questions you can start asking yourself. Mm-hmm. Okay, like where's the problem? And that was so manual, even just understanding for a particular report, what are all the upstream sources that are contributing to it was insanely manual. I actually remember we like got into a room. This is with someone who worked with us at Monte Carlo today. His name is Will Robbins. And, you know, Will and I got into a room and we just like on a whiteboard manually mapped all of the connections and basically the lineage of our data. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is really unreasonable for us to have to do this. What is everyone else in the world doing? Like, you know, there's no way that this is what actually should make sense. And if we're serious about this data thing, you know, and we really want to use data, we better start understanding where it's coming from. And we can't be, you know, manually on a board drawing out the map of lineage every time there's a problem. This is just not going to work. And so we actually like hacked together our own solution, credit to Will. And it worked out quite well for ourselves. And we had our customers asking for a similar solution. So we implemented for them. Mm. And I was like, this is so crazy. Like, you know, I don't understand, what are other people doing? And you know, I think I was sort of like left with that feeling, and obviously like I was at Gainsight at the time, and you know, was really focused on my work there, but those were sort of the initial kind of sparks and seeds for what became later Monte Carlo.
Mm-hmm. I can so resonate with that. I remember when I joined Amazon, I thought, oh, in a big company, all our table is gonna be perfectly labeled and organized. And you don't know, like a lot of teams, sometimes they collect their own data, not everything going to like a central data lake. So a lot of those data lineage or even definition of the things, I only learned through having meetings with someone, and I have to write it down in the document. It's very manual. And when you work in teams or you just kind of take it for granted, you just think this is the common thing you do. You need to have some meeting, have documentation, and if someone makes some changes, update the documentation, but or you can look at some logs of the table. It's the type of knowledge only lives within the team. And when someone new joins, or if you want to collaborate with a different team, there's always some sort of misunderstanding there.
That's exactly right. That is just the reality for probably every single person watching. You have to talk to people, you have to be in meetings, you have to document it. It's crazy. It's nuts that we have to do all of that in order to work with data. And it's ironic because it's like, you know, what's the only thing that we needed is for the data to be right. And we actually can't get that, right? It really seemed ridiculous to me. And I think the thing that exacerbated it was, you know, when I was looking at my peers or counterparts, like in engineering, for example, they had all these solutions to actually make sure that software was reliable and accurate and on time and working well. And so why couldn't we figure out, like, why didn't we have some corollary for data, right? And so those are kind of like all the questions that sort of kept popping up for me at the time when I was facing this. But I think, you know, sort of speaking to hundreds of people, they all shared the same pain. And they were all, you know, thinking through, you know, is how are we going to manage this?
So I have a question about you decided to found Monte Carlo as a company. How did you know this solving the data lineage or data quality problem is not just a small feature or like Chrome plugin? How do you know it could be a full service company would buy?
Yeah, great question. So I think there were a couple of things that happened at the same time. First of all, data became really important. And I think that's even more true today, right? If you look at the rise of Snowflake, Databricks, Redshift, you know, rumored to be the fastest growing AWS service, BigQuery, each of these companies has between $1 billion and $2 billion of revenue, not market cap, just revenue. That means that lots of people are making a ton of investments in their data infrastructure. On top of that, think about the rise of the data science as, you know, as a role, the rise of the data engineer, the analytics engineer, the data product manager, a totally new title, which I'm a huge fan of, by the way. Like all these different professionals that have emerged as data. And by the way, if you also look at this, even in like the most, you know, recent sort of macro environment that we're in, companies are still incredibly bullish on data. Data is continuing to be at the center of operations for companies. So that's sort of one thing. And of course, with that comes more data sources, more data volume, more people working with data. The second thing is, you know, I was speaking with hundreds of data leaders and asking them, what's keeping you up at night? Like, what's your biggest problem? And people kept on referring to this problem again and again, you know, saying things like, you know, we can't actually like trust the data. And then we lose credibility as a data team when the data is wrong. Or, you know, when my team spends 4 out of 5 days in the week actually firefighting data issues, we can't get anything done. Or, you know, we are trying to democratize data in our company and have everyone, each function use data, but we can't do that because the data is wrong and nobody can trust the data. That's the most common thing that I kept hearing from people. And it came up as one of their like top three problems. People would tell me, I'm waking up sweating at night because I'm not sure if the data that I'm presenting tomorrow is right or not, right? There are strong emotions related to that. And in 2016, actually, like Netflix was down for 45 minutes because of wrong data. You know, Netflix being down for 45 minutes is like unheard of, right? It's like a full Selling Sunset episode or something like that that I could be watching. And not only was it down for such a long time, but it was down because of wrong data. It was actually duplicate data. And that actually started this whole sort of work stream at Netflix to build something that they called RAD, Robust Anomaly Detection, and a whole other slew of sort of initiatives around making sure that data is reliable. Because today, and back then started to happen, data actually powers applications. And so when your apps is down, it's oftentimes because the data is wrong. And, you know, I would say all of these things really made me realize that, like, if we are relying on data more and more, it better be right. I'll give you another more recent example, Equifax, which is, you know, a credit score company. You know, if you need to get a credit score, if you're trying to get, you know, like a mortgage or a loan or to buy a car, you need a credit score. Equifax made it public a couple of months ago that actually they assigned millions of wrong credit scores because of bad data. And so that's, you know, millions of users and real people like can't get a loan or a mortgage or whatever it is because of bad data. Like, yeah. How terrible is that, right? Or on the business front, like Unity, for example, it's a gaming company. They had one problem with actually their advertising data that was wrong that cost them $100 million.
Oh, wow.
One data problem. Like, think about all the things that are not reported, right? These are things that... don't always make it to the public. Mm-hmm. And so, but everyone knows about it and every company has this issue. And so I think the thing that really helped me understand was there was no industry that was spared, right? Financial services, media, retail, whoever's using data has this problem. Mm-hmm. And there's no size of company. So, you know, small organizations that have like 5-10 people on their data team up until like Netflix and Meta and other companies who have like hundreds of thousands of people and, you know, thousands of data people working on these problems. And so, you know, that really sort of, you know, gave me the conviction that, you know, this is a problem that's real for people today and it's going to get worse. And the implications are severe on society and on business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you mentioned sometimes duplication or outliers. What are some other common issues with data quality?
Great question. So actually, when we first started the company, the number one thing that people told us was like, hey, my data is a snowflake. Like my data is different than your data. So when my data is wrong, it's very different than when your data is wrong. And I think that's right, right? Like every company uses data differently and aggregates different kinds of data.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, right? We kept on going back to corollaries from software engineering and software observability and software reliability. Mm. And even for engineering, like there's a certain set, there's a framework or a certain set of metrics that capture and give, you know, capture the health of your systems and give engineering teams, specifically SRE teams, site reliability engineers, the information they need to make sure that applications, infrastructure, software is reliable and accurate. We said, why can't we create the same framework for data teams, right? So understanding what are the common patterns for how data is wrong. And so we actually went to hundreds of people that we spoke with and we asked them, tell me about all the times that the data is wrong. What happened? And then tell me about how you troubleshooted it. And there were actually patterns emerging from that. So I'll give you sort of a couple examples and I'll explain how we codified them into one framework. But the most common example that we heard was the data was late and we didn't know about it. So we expected the data to come in at 8 a.m. You know, let's say there's like an API from Meta, from Facebook, and I expect the data at 8 a.m. every day and it just didn't arrive and I didn't get notified about it. And it's like 11 a.m. and the team wants to use the data and they can't. And I don't know. Super basic example, happens all the time.
Yeah.
Another example, you know, the job was completed. So actually, like, you know, we have the data, but it's all null values. Like there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Right. And I didn't know about it. Happens all the time. Or another example, someone upstream made a change, made a schema change. Like, for example, they changed the type of field. Mm. Or, you know, maybe they actually like deleted a table or deleted a field and they didn't know that someone downstream actually is relying on that field. Never happened to me. This is like, you know, sharing for a friend. Yeah. Definitely not something that's common. No, I'm kidding. These are the examples that come up again and again and again, right? And in all of these instances, it's involving like multiple people making changes and other people not being aware of it. And, you know, we actually use that to codify what we call the five pillars of data observability. Mm. So data observability is a corollary to software observability. So the way that, you know, engineering teams understand the health and reliability of software is by using software, what we call software observability. That's something that's been around for a very long time, 5 to 10 years, and is very well understood. The concept of data observability is the concept of understanding the health of your data based on the outputs of that system and based on the outputs of what we call the five pillars of data observability. And we've seen teams who have automated their approach to data observability by actually implementing these five pillars and being able to have sort of three key benefits. One is being the first to know about data issues. So no longer are the days when you hear about someone, you know, hear about an issue from someone downstream. So be the first to catch an issue. The second is sort of speed up the resolution of an incident. And so oftentimes what ends up happening is I'll hear about an issue from someone, but then it's going to take me weeks or months to understand what happened, right? And then the third is actually like preventing these issues to begin with. So if we have, you know, instrumented a strong approach to data observability, we should reduce the number of incidents, right? Something that we actually refer to is kind of data downtime, which is periods of time when data is wrong or inaccurate or otherwise erroneous. It's a corollary to software downtime, to application downtime.
Yeah.
And so the idea of data observability is to help build strong, reliable pipelines that minimize data downtime. We probably can't get to zero. We can probably manage it in a controlled way. And so, you know, going back to your question on, you know, what are common reasons for why data goes wrong, we came up with these five pillars that help capture the common reasons for how data teams manage incidents. So the first is freshness. And so freshness is all about making sure that the data that you have is actually up to date. So if, you know, a particular table needs to get updated three times a day, every single day, but it hasn't been updated at all today, you probably want to know about that. Something might be delayed. That's the first pillar. The second pillar is volume. And so volume of the data, you know, pretty straightforward, basically understanding whether it's like number of rows or size of the file, help you understand whether it's actually the volume of data that you expect. So going back to our earlier example, you know, if you, so we're expecting, you know, 10 new rows today and there's only one, you know, maybe something's wrong.
Yeah. It happens so often.
Yes, exactly. Maybe you can guess the third pillar, which is schema changes. Schema changes are the culprit of many issues with data downtime.
Yeah.
And so under schema changes, I would consider, you know, anything that's changed to the organization of the data, like a table deleted, a field changed in type, right? Happen all the time.
Yeah.
The fourth pillar is what we call quality. And that's really referring to like field level itself. So like a particular example would be, you know, if you have customer IDs and you suddenly have like a negative customer ID, like a negative value, probably doesn't make sense.
Right.
Or if you have credit card numbers and then suddenly there's a letter in that credit card, right? Or for example, if... you know, you're looking, you know, at fields that are between the ranges of 2 and 5. And suddenly, you know, you get the number 2000, right? Then obviously, like, doesn't make sense. Like, you can't have a credit score with 2000.
Yeah.
For example. And then the fifth pillar is lineage. And when I say lineage, I mean an automated understanding of the connections between data assets. And those could be tables or fields, and those have to be cross-system. So it's not just within your data warehouse, but it's between, let's say, your data warehouse and your BI solution, for example. So it's basically a map of how are all the different tables related to each other and how are those related to their reports. And what that really sort of what this pillar helps is bring the whole story together and say, okay, you know, the interesting thing about data downtime or data issues is that when it happens, like everything goes wrong together, right? Or oftentimes there's multiple things that are contributing to a problem. So for example, someone might have made a schema change upstream, which caused a particular table downstream that's related to it to have a freshness problem, which might have a volume problem in a downstream table, which might actually have like an incorrect value in a report downstream. And so lineage helps you piece all that together and understand what are the different sort of breaking points along the way.
Yeah. I can also resonate with the schema change. I think sometimes data engineers or software engineers make a change and there are a few people maybe on the engineering team subscribe to the table, they get notification, but the downstream users like data scientists or data analysts, they don't know when it's made some change. Again, it's through some maybe small meetings or conversation you realize, oh, there was a change, but it just requires a lot of communication and some manual work. It would be nice if it automatically notify or identify the business team that might use this table. And then so we can sleep at night. We don't need to worry about those changes.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. And so how does Monte Carlo work? So for example, do people use Monte Carlo? Does it identify all the tables, automatically identify the lineage changes? And how do you identify those, say, outliers or other data quality issues?
So I'll start by actually explaining what Monte Carlo does, if that helps. So Monte Carlo is a data observability platform. The problem that we solve is, you know, when you, exactly what I described earlier, when you wake up on, you know, Monday morning or Friday afternoon, and suddenly someone is like, WTF, is the data wrong here?
Yeah.
That's exactly the problem that we solve. And we solve that by reducing what we call data downtime, periods of time when data is wrong. I'll explain a little bit about the product, but just, you know, about the company.
Yeah.
The best way to think about this is just like Datadog, but for your data team.
Mm-hmm.
And so for data product managers, data analysts, data scientists, data engineers, so many people today building data products. It could be a machine learning model. It could be a report. It could be a dashboard, whatever data product or data asset it is. And they are responsible to make sure that that data is accurate. And it's incredibly manual and hard to do that today. Mm-hmm. And so companies work with Monte Carlo to help make sure that their data is reliable and accurate. And so, you know, we're fortunate to work with companies like JetBlue, you know, a leading airline,
yeah,
that helps, you know, make sure that your suitcases get on time, mm-hmm, that you're catching your connecting flight. Work with companies like CNN, Fox, Media, PagerDuty, Gusto, many, many others who use data to both power decision making internally, but also their operational products. Now, to your question on like, how do we actually do it? Which is a great question. So basically, the idea is that data is oftentimes, or kind of like a typical data stack, might include a data warehouse like Snowflake or BigQuery or Redshift, maybe a data lake. You know, those two are getting closer, similar together. It might be like Databricks, S3, and you know, might have a BI, so maybe Tableau or Looker, use an ETL, maybe a reverse ETL. And so the idea is that data might actually change and go wrong in any of those points. And so what Monte Carlo does is connects your data stack, what we call end-to-end, so including your data lake, your data warehouse, your ETL, your BI solution. And then what we do is we basically automatically learn sort of at a very high level, two things. One is the lineage. So we actually reconstruct both table level and field level lineage automatically based on basically parse the query logs to do that. And then the second thing is we learn patterns in your data. So for example, for freshness, we automatically detect the update pattern for a particular table. And so by observing a table, we can see, okay, this table gets updated once a week.
Yeah.
This table gets updated 5 times a day. That are those are things that we can learn automatically, mm-hmm, with machine learning models, basically.
Yeah.
Then there's a third component, which actually allows people or data teams to specify custom rules or specify specific things that they'd like to know about their data. Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, you can say the values in this particular field have to be between 2 and 10. And if they're ever higher or lower, I need to know about that.
Yeah.
Or this data needs to arrive every morning at 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. And if it's arriving a minute later, I need to know.
Yeah.
So those are kind of like the three core things.
Okay, gotcha. And you mentioned one thing you do is to parse some logs from their current system. And as a data scientist, so a question I would have is, what is the trade-off between I build an in-house system, I can parse my own logs, I understand my system better, and I can customize it versus adopting an external service like Monte Carlo?
Yeah, I think it has to do with a couple of things. First is, you know, how much time are you spending on this internally?
Mm.
And is there anything else better that you can or want to do?
Yeah.
So most data teams, we've done a survey, actually spend anywhere between 30 to 80% of their time on firefighting data issues. That is an, you know, incredibly high amount of time. Think about all the time that you could do that to actually work on, you know, revenue generating products or innovation, right? And so for those teams, the reality is that they are either firefighting, they're so busy firefighting, they don't have time to build a proactive solution, right? I think the second thing is the implications of it. So we talked about data issues where, you know, one incident can cause $100 million, right? And so in the Unity example, and so in those instances for companies, you know, it's oftentimes sort of easier to actually like work with a solution that's off the shelf, that can be reliable and have, you know, have been built for years and is based on learnings from hundreds of customers and sort of best practices in place today. And so I think what we're seeing, it's a new category, right? So a couple of years, like data observability didn't exist. But I think what we're seeing the modern data stack converge on is, if you already invested in a data lake, a data warehouse, an ETL, and a BI, you might as well have a data observability solution to make sure that all your investment was not, you know, for nothing, and that you can actually, you know, see an ROI on your investment. You know, you've invested in like best in class infrastructure. How can you afford to not make sure that that data is also accurate, reliable? Sort of a little bit irresponsible to not do that.
And previously you mentioned some customers of Monte Carlo. I'm curious if you could share some specific stories. What is like before and after they use Monte Carlo? Any specific problem they identified?
Yeah, I feel like I should ask you. It sounds like you had a couple experiences with some of these issues. I should probably ask you for a couple examples if you want to share. Do you want to share?
Yeah, I think what I have done is mostly manual. Definitely have experiences. So I used to work on a platform that has a lot of query logs, like you mentioned, and I need to go into the logs and then work with engineers and the data engineers team to see basically what are some common issues that comes out, and then you like categorize them and then triage them. A lot of times I feel, although data science is a team sport, we collaborate with engineers, but a lot of times they have, their plate is full. They don't have time to always help you debug. So at that time, I have to spend a lot of time to basically understand what they're doing and then track the kind of the upstream or downstream issue, and then create some ticket in a format that they can understand and they can help me resolve it. I think a lot of times data scientists have to wear different hats. And if you just feel, hey, you own this table and you need to solve this for me, they don't really understand it or they don't have time to prioritize. I don't think data scientists should solve every problems, but you have to understand the issue deep enough and then create a ticket that's so specific, they know exactly where they need to make changes on the code or what specifically table they need to look at. You have to do the root causing for them and then they can do the fix. You can't just say, hey, the number isn't correct, can you fix it? They don't know how to fix it for you. So that's my own experience, how to do it manually.
Yeah, that's great. That's reality for, you know, most teams today. I think you described it perfectly. I should be interviewing you. So, you know, I'll share a couple examples of sort of other, you know, teams, customers. I think the before, you described it so well, right? You're spending your days trying to convince other people that they need to help you fix the data.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to do that. They have other things to do. You don't know what the root cause is. You need to spend so much time figuring out the root cause. And mostly, you know, that could drag on forever. And that's if you got lucky and learned about the issue, right?
Yeah.
There might be issues that you don't even know about and you're going to hear about it from a customer later on, right, which is even worse. You know, I think the after state is you're the first to know about issues. You know about it before anyone else. You resolve it really quickly. You understand the root cause, and you actually learn something new that you can prevent it to begin from, you know, from happening from the first place. So specific folks that, you know, we've seen this live. I'll take for example JetBlue. as a customer. So JetBlue is a leading airline, mm-hmm. and they have a really strong data team. The head of the data engineering team, her name is Ashley. And you know, when we met her, they're actually a huge user of Snowflake and DBT, one of the world's biggest users of DBT, I believe. And you know, they were really relying on sort of manual efforts, like you mentioned, and testing the data, and trying to scale use of data at JetBlue while making sure the data is accurate. And so they had a couple use cases for data. One is actually to power their support team, which again, you might answer questions like, where's my luggage? And like, what's my connecting flight? And, you know, what time does my flight arrive? What are the flights for today, right?
Yeah.
Kind of basic questions that you have. And they needed to make sure that data is accurate. And so they actually had sort of a team, you know, they call it eyes on glass to manually make sure that the data is accurate. And that was clearly not scalable, right? And so working with Monte Carlo, they were able to implement, you know, the solution end to end on their data stack, on their data warehouse, their BI, their ETL, and start actually like having kind of like two things fundamentally. One, understanding the structure of the data, understanding mm-hmm. who's making changes where, and two, getting sort of early alerts or notifications when there's a change that might indicate that something is wrong. And they're actually like super meticulous about, you know, making sure that they're responding and triaging every single alert and every single instance, and actually using, you know, sort of the tools at their disposal to understand the root cause, triage, you know, what has changed where, actually were able to significantly reduce the rate of data incidents that they had. I'll add another thing that's really important. The deployment is super easy. So you might ask yourself, oh, like, you know, it might take me like a couple of weeks, or maybe there's some manual work involved. Actually, in the case of JetBlue, you know, it was like within half an hour or something, you know, up and running. Within a day, could start sort of seeing lineage and getting insights. And I think for many data teams, they're so busy, they don't have time to like start deploying something for months and waiting for results. And I think that's really important for kind of modern data teams.
Yeah. And I think JetBlue, for example, is a big company. And for example, there are some companies or team that just started to collect data and do some experimentations on the data. So when does data observability make sense for data team to adopt, or when doesn't make sense?
Great question. I would say the minute that you have those, you know, kind of like the foundation of the data stack, mm-hmm. so a data warehouse, a BI, an ETL, you should have a data observability solution. It's quite simple. I think the minute that you have some of that data, if the data is wrong, you just lose the trust off the bat. So like, you know, sort of an organization called Drata, they're, you know, one of the fastest growing security companies in the world. And, you know, I think they're a team of kind of a couple hundred of people in the company, and their head of data, his name is Lior. He actually worked with us with Monte Carlo prior at his company, Vimeo. Mm-hmm. So for folks who don't know, Vimeo is a large organization, video platform, online video platform, and they use data, you know, to make decisions on like, you know, does a particular user have sufficient bandwidth, for example. All those decisions, you know, need to be using reliable data, right? So whether it's the user have sufficient bandwidth, or is a marketing campaign the right marketing campaign? Are we sharing, you know, are we showing the right ads to people? And so Lior actually started working with us at Vimeo. And then later on, when he joined Drata and he started up a team basically from scratch, just a couple of folks, he was like, the first thing I need is data observability, because I want to build, you know, the credibility that we are a team that uses trusted data. And so when people come to us across the company, they know that what we're providing with them is trusted, reliable data. And we're doing that from day one. There's no question about that. Mm. Just another fun example. So Fox, for example, you know, it was just recently the Super Bowl. If you saw Rihanna in the halftime, and, you know, sort of obviously NFL, and you know, a lot of other sort of events around that. So Fox streams all of that. Mm. And so there's tons of data that's collected in that process, right? Yeah. Like all the different users and devices and content sessions and ads, and all of that data is actually power to make real-time decisions to optimize the experience and to personalize the experience. Mm-hmm. And so we're really proud to work with Fox and sort of you know, make sure that that data is accurate and reliable.
Yeah. And now with the data observability, so who owns data quality? Is it the data scientists who are using it, or the data engineers who's building a table, or the software engineers building the infrastructure?
It sort of reminds me of like the Oprah GIF where it's like, you get a car, you get a car, you get a car, right? Right. Kind of like that.
Or
it's
the
like,
Spider-Man meme.
Exactly. That's right. It's like, you own data quality. You're right. So I think there's also truth to it, right? To your point, there's so many people. There's like the engineers and the data engineers and the data analysts and data scientists, and they're all responsible for data quality. I think the hard thing is that there isn't a centralized place to talk about that or to communicate. And to your point, it's like in a meeting or if you like by chance ask them. But I don't think we can get away from that. And I will say, I do think that it's an organization's decision to make data quality a top priority that allows these teams to solve it together. And so we're more and more seeing actually like executive level OKRs or initiatives around make sure that we can use data and that the data is accurate and trusted. And that allows all of these different teams to do their part in making sure that the data is accurate and reliable. And that means, first of all, in my opinion, having observability to make sure that you know that you actually know when there's a data issue and you can you know, move from this very reactive world where you're finding about data issues later to being proactive where you're building healthy, reliable pipelines.
Yeah. And now with the data observability, what do you think is the next big challenge for data teams?
Great question. I think this is a really interesting time for data teams, I would say. Like, I think, you know, the last sort of, I mentioned 10 years ago, everybody was like, oh yeah, we're data driven. I don't think that was true, actually. Like, I think we just said it because we wanted to say it and we felt important saying it, but we weren't really using data. I think it's, you know, it was like a handful of people using data in a small pocket over the organization, and they were using data like once a quarter.
It's like a checkbox.
Exactly. Yes. Or, you know, it's like, okay, it's funny. On the one hand, it's a checkbox, like, okay, we're data driven. On the other hand, the most fundamental questions, like how many customers we have, super hard to answer for like most organizations. And it's like the most basic question.
Counting is extremely hard.
Counting is hard. Exactly. We haven't figured out how to count. No one has. I think that, and by the way, so that hasn't changed, right? It's still the main problem that we have today. We don't know how to count. We haven't solved that. I don't know how to solve that also, to be totally frank. But I think, you know, it's a stark difference from today, but it's worth remembering that just like a hot second ago, no one was really using data, checking the box to your point. And today, you know, not uncommon for every single team to be a data team, really. Like, doesn't matter what you are, like product engineering, sales, marketing, customer success, you're using data. You have someone on your team who's like analyzing the data, maybe in real time, maybe not, doesn't matter, but you're all using data. That is a stark difference. And also there's this, you know, kind of on the topic of buzzy words, there's this emergence of the modern data stack, right? And so whether you're using Snowflake, Databricks, you know, BigQuery, whatever, you know, your flavor, data teams are on the hook now. They've made, like, companies made a big bet on data. They've invested a lot. And data teams, it's like, it's money time for them now. They're like, okay, so now that we've invested so much, show me the money. Like, prove that this is valuable. And first of all, I think that's an awesome spot to be in. Like, I think there's a lot of sort of, like, spotlight on data teams. And it's great. Like, I think this is, like, the data team's opportunity to shine. And I do think that that starts with having like the credibility and trust so that the data that you're using is actually accurate. And now, you know, it's really time for us, like, step into that, own this, right? Like, step into our power and actually deliver sort of on the promise that that data has had for a long time.
And for the folks, maybe they're not familiar with why we're saying counting is hard. So for my experience, for example, there could be some customers sign up 3 months ago and then they cancel their plan after 3 months, or someone sign up because they got a credit they didn't really pay. Are they a customer or not? Or the the customer only stayed for a short period of time, are they a customer or not? So there are a lot of questions based on kind of how you define what is a customer, what is a paying customer. So before you want to count how many customer you have or generate any metrics, you have to understand what is the business definition of that. And then that can help you guide you through what kind of number you want to have. You talk a little bit about the modern data stack. What do you think about the most critical component, or is there anything missing there?
It's so true. I'm just, just resonating. I'll just riff on that for a second. I think it's both, what does even count as a customer?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like you might have a customer that's like, paying month to month, and a customer that's annual, and a customer that's in proof of concept. Like, what do you consider as a customer?
Yeah.
And then there's also actually like different ways of tallying it up, right? So, maybe in some system of record, you see that you have like 10 customers, and another system of record, you see 11, and you don't even understand the definitions to understand why, right? Mm-hmm. I speak with data practitioners and leaders on a pretty regular basis. And I want to tell you, like, the hottest topic that people are asking me about now is like how to prove our value as a data team and how to show the ROI.
Right.
And we actually wrote a blog post about this that kind of talks about looking sort of at an attribution model, basically, to say like how much, revenue uplift you've contributed per function. So like, how does a data team help the marketing team generate more revenue or the sales team more revenue or the customer success team more revenue? Like, let's take, for example, customer success. The data team can help by doing an analysis of like which companies might be prime for an expansion right now, or, which organizations are using particular products and might, have an inclination to try similar products to it. And you can actually like look at the impact there on the business and measure that back to mm-hmm. the data team. It's obviously a lot harder to do. It's very, very hard. And so some companies try to do it directionally, mm-hmm. but I would say like that's really one of the things that folks are struggling with. I think the other thing that, we are personally working a lot with companies on is on looking at some metrics sort of actually around data reliability.
Yeah.
So whether that's time to detection. So if in the past it took like, 7 days or longer to identify an issue, can you reduce that to a couple of hours? Mm. The second is time to resolution. So from, when an incident started until it's resolved, can you shorten that time?
Yeah.
And then overall, like percentage uptime or downtime, like what percentage, defining SLAs actually for like, high importance asset that you've mm-hmm. identified. Maybe there's some key tables that are most important, and kind of holding yourself accountable to metrics like data uptime.
Yeah. I think measuring the ROI of a data team is really hard, especially part of their job is to generate some insights, and they could inspire a business decision, but it might not necessarily resulting in an immediate ROI. So, but you also know you have to have a data team here. You need to measure things. So do you have any advice on how to specifically measure the ROI? So besides the time you saved, what are some other things you can measure the ROI for example, a specific piece of insights or a research you've done?
Yeah. So there's various ways that teams measure. I'll just, mention a couple. One is operational efficiency. So mm-hmm. to your point, how much time have you saved for a particular function? The second is reducing time to insights. Mm-hmm. So from the time that you have a particular question to actually being able to answer that. Actually, Red Ventures is one of our customers who's done a lot of work on that. The third example could be actually like new revenue generated. So if the data team did some analysis that resulted in a new product, a new go-to-market strategy, an expansion or upsell opportunity, those can be sort of attributed back to the team. Mm-hmm. So folks look at that. I would also say, in stronger personalization products. So for example, going back to the Netflix example, right? Like recommending the right products to you at the right time and the right audience. This is particularly relevant actually for financial companies who want to recommend, you know, the right packages, the right solutions based on what they know about you and your history.
Yeah.
In all of those instances, data can actually, you know, you can build a better product. And so in those cases, the ROI is a lot clearer. Yeah. I would say the closer the data team's work is to real business outcomes, the easier it is to explain that ROI.
Mm, yeah, that makes a lot of sense because now in the economy, we see a lot of layoffs in tech companies and then also impact some data teams. So sometimes it's hard for the team to justify this headcount. I think it's important to kind of think about what are some impact you have made. So when you talk to leaders in data teams, do you feel they're concerned about their teams getting laid off, or you feel their mission is more critical now?
You know, I would say generally, you know, for many organizations, you know, it's definitely, you know, a tough time, right? Yeah. Like I would say it's a very turbulent market and a lot of changes, right? And many companies are obviously experiencing layoffs.
Yeah.
I will say that including those companies who are doing that, we are seeing increased investments in data and in data teams. And so I think companies are understanding that actually, you know, turning to software and data to help create an advantage in this market is sort of the right bet to make. And so across the board, we are seeing companies actually doubling down on data, continuing to hire data teams, continuing to build data products.
Yeah.
I think it was Shopify that maybe just a few years ago had like 20 data products and they're supposed to have like over 200 and growing. And so if you're continuing, if part of your sort of core product and offering strategy is around data, and more companies are moving in that direction. And so we are seeing across the board folks being very bullish on data.
Yeah. And I guess 1 or 2 years ago, when we hear the word data product, it just feels like such a fuzzy word. And when people think about data, oh, it's either a table or reports or some machine learning product. And people start to realize a data is a product and you need product managers to think about who is using it, what is the customer experience and the entire end-to-end workflow. So I'm very excited to see this change and people taking data more seriously. And as we're recording now, yesterday, ChatGPT just launched their API. So what do you think about AI-assisted tools? What does it mean for data teams?
Yeah, I'm excited. You know, I mean, a couple of thoughts. One, I think that technology has been around for a while, actually, right? We know that in sort of in Google and many others. So I don't think it's new, but I think it's been wildly popularized, obviously, with ChatGPT. Right. You know, I've personally used it a couple of times, you know, writing, you know, testing out, you know, what is data observability and, you know, what does it mean to be a data engineer and sort of all these philosophical questions and kind of having fun with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think that there's a real possibility that ChatGPT or other AI changes the way that we work with data or, you know, offers different ways to think about it, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, one thing that I heard is that, you know, the way that you write the prompt in ChatGPT actually makes a big difference. And so there might be like prompt engineers, which helped you like craft the right prompt to get the answer you want. And so that's like a totally new world that you can think about. So it might change the way in which we interact with data. But I think fundamentally, you know, it'll make us better. It'll reduce time to, if we're doing things right.
Yeah.
It should reduce time to insight, reduce the time that we're spending on things that we don't want to do, and actually even further make data a bigger deal. So to your question before, the biggest thing is I don't see data becoming not important or less important. It's actually the opposite. And I think solutions like ChatGPT, which are now being popularized, are going to even further accelerate that. So I think it's overall very good news for the data industry.
Yeah. And now looking back at your journey, what are some mistakes you have made in your career besides sitting there looking too much in the table?
there have been many. There's been so many mistakes. It's funny, you know, I think maybe very early when we just started in Monte Carlo, you know, yeah. I spoke to sort of hundreds of you know, data folks. I mentioned this and like asked, what are the top issues? And kind of came up with, you know, the sort of the framework for how we want to build a solution for this and what it means. And then, you know, I partnered with my co-founder, Lior, and I was like, okay, Lior, well, you know, why don't you like go build a solution and like let me know when you're done. And you know, see you later, like enjoy, you know, have fun. And Lior was like, no way, like we need to work hand in hand with a real customer.
Yeah.
And we have to go find a customer that has a real problem right now, and we're going to solve that problem. We're not building anything, you know, in the dark alone. Mm-hmm. We are building hand in hand with customers. And I yeah. think that sort of set the DNA for the company, and every single thing that we build with a customer. We're never going to like go like, you know, sit some room, think about the problem, and then come talk to you. It's yeah. going to be with a real customer that we can point to, a real pain point. Mm. And I'll be honest, like almost everything that I thought would work in the product didn't work. And the things that I thought wouldn't work did. So very early on, I learned that my gut is actually very wrong. Like, I'll give you an example. In the very first sort of days of building our MVP, you know, we folks asked us for just an Excel file with like schema changes. That's it. They're like, just send it to us. We'd be so happy.
Yeah.
And I was like, how? Like, you can go get that on your own. Like, mm-hmm. why do you need it? And customers were just so incredibly happy and you know, wanting more of that. And so I really learned that, like, I think there's like a room for, going back to maybe the beginning of the conversation,
yeah.
there's room for gut and intuition. Mm. But at the end of the day, like you have to test things with customers. And yeah. oftentimes, by the way, customers might tell you, I really want something. But then when you put it in front of them, they actually don't. Mm. They want something else.
Yeah.
And so really leaning into that, I think that is something that I have to keep reminding myself all the time, is to actually sort of to a certain degree, like ignore your gut and intuition and talk to the data, talk to your customers and listen to the data.
Yeah. And even if when you show your customer some of your result is not exactly what you want, you still get a feedback. Sometimes when you are a data scientist, you work with stakeholder, they don't know what they want. But when they see, oh, this is not what we want, it helps them to think. You need to give them something to work with. So I think that step is really important, and don't feel frustrated if you have a meeting and then they don't like what you show. It's still productive. It's keep the thing moving.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Couldn't have said it better.
And how did you meet our co-founder?
I started the company, mm-hmm. Sort of spoke with, you know, kind of lots of folks, and actually met various co-founders.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was really important to me was, you know, working with someone who was shared in terms of, we had a shared understanding of what kind of company we wanted to build, sort yeah. of values. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that we talked about, customer impact, that mm-hmm. is our very first value. That's the most important thing. We're building something in order to make an impact on someone's life, not, you know, just for it to sit somewhere.
Yeah.
We talked about ship and iterate. That's actually another value of the company. Mm-hmm. So, you know, shipping things fast and learning from that, right? Versus the other option. You know, another of our value is have fun, like being proud of the journey. You know, life is short. We want to work on things that we care about and doing it with people that we care about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, finding someone who was shared with that, and then also someone who was passionate about the space and wanted to, you know, was excited about this new category, data observability. You kind of have to be crazy to start a new category. It's, you know, you, when you start a company, it's like 99.9% chance that you fail and it, you're still doing it. So you need to be really excited about what you're doing. You know, Lior, who actually is my husband, I spoke with like a potential customer, and he was like, how are you not working with your husband? He has like the perfect background for this. And, you know, I was like, I don't know about that. But then actually that like sparked the idea. Mm-hmm. And then we actually started working together. And Lior's background is in security and data. Mm-hmm. And so he started a company prior.
Perfect.
Yeah, exactly. And he had a lot of experiences from starting a company. Mm-hmm. And so we just started working together. And yeah, it's been really fun.
Oh, that's awesome. So having a great co-founder is important. And along your journey, do you have a mentor you learned a lot from?
Oh, great question. Probably customers are like my biggest mentors.
Yeah.
You know, when I run into a problem, like I'm not sure, you know, I'll just give you an example. Like we're rethinking pricing, for example. No one knows the answer. No one can help me but like our customers. And so I'll oftentimes like, you know, give them a call and like ask them how should we think about this. Mm. I've had customers give me advice about the name of the company.
Oh, really?
Yeah, their advice about like our website.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, especially in the early days of a startup, your customers, they're kind of like along with you on the journey. Mm. You know, they're like, they want to see your success. They're rooting for you. Like our early customers like text me when like we release new things. They're like, oh, this is amazing. I'm so excited. Yeah. Or, you know, when we make a big announcement. And so having those people alongside the journey with you and being able to like bring them in and to have them like speak with our team and share their story has been really special. So I would say like more than anything, I learned the most from our customers.
Yeah. Building a startup can be stressful sometimes. What is like a challenging time when you feel really stressed and how did you overcome it?
This is probably a cop-out answer, but like everything is stressful and hard when you start a company. Like nothing is working for you. Like, you know, getting your first customer just seems impossible.
Yeah.
Getting your first employee, like why would anyone join you? Mm. Getting the first investment. You don't get anything for free. Everything is freaking hard. I don't advise. No, I'm kidding. it is really hard. Mm. But the good thing is that your kind of perception of difficult changes, right? And I found myself actually leaning into that. And so, and actually wanting to memorize that in some way. And so, we actually, one of our values is called beat the odds. And the idea is like, you know, we try to do impossible things. You know, I mentioned before, the chances of, you know, when you start a company, the chances of failure are 99.9%. So you are waking up every day and doing something that is by definition going to fail.
Yeah.
And yet you still wake up every day and do that. And so you kind of have to be okay with that and lean into that and just forget about that. Like, I don't know, open a drawer and like forget about that part, you know, of information.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our value, beat the odds, is around, you know, if we haven't like failed or heard no, we haven't tried hard enough.
Yeah.
And it is, the journey is about trying to do these really hard things, pulling each other together as a team and winning as a team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has really helped me in sort of dealing with like the reality that, yeah, everything really is hard.
Yeah. And now you have a lot of customers sharing success stories. So is there a specific point you realize, oh, we're actually fine. We're out of the beating the odds area. We're thinking about growth.
I don't think so. For me, first of all, it's about the journey. Really, yeah. Like I have so much fun with my team members. I learn so much from them every day. I feel myself really, really fortunate that I can wake up and work on things that I think are so important. You know, if we can help, you know, companies like Roche, you know, have like clinical data be accurate, or, you know, if we can help companies, you know, like CNN and New York Times, you know, delivering reliable data for in all of these organizations is so important. And I really fundamentally believe that data can make the world better. And if we can have a small part in that, I would be so proud. And also it's real people, you know, I like know like Ashley from JetBlue and like Sharon from New York Times and, you know, all these people who like, yeah, if I save or if we as a team, like we're able to save time for them or like, you know, let them sleep better at night. You know, we can make a change in the world. And I think that gives me a lot of motivation and fulfillment.
Yeah. And while I'm talking to you, I can feel the passion and energy you have when you talk about data and data observability. So before we wrap up, what is something you are looking forward to this year?
Yes, I'm very excited about this year. Specifically, my daughter, Ray, is celebrating 2 years in next week.
Oh, okay.
So she'll be turning 2 years. So really excited about that.
My birthday is also next week. So
oh, no way.
It's a good week.
That's awesome. So is Lior, my co-friend and husband. So
Pisces.
Yeah, yay. Exactly. Yeah, that's right. So really excited about that. And then I would say, you know, obviously like, you know, you know, with sort of COVID in the last couple of years, it's been really nice seeing people in person, and especially like, you know, meeting customers and team members and upcoming conferences in the summer, and just kind of getting together with folks. We met together at a conference, right?
Several months ago. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And so I love those sort of events and ability to kind of connect in person. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah, that was a great event, by the way. So for folks who want to learn more about Monte Carlo or data observability best practices, where can I find more information?
Yeah, so our website is montecarlodata.com. We have a very extensive blog. We write a lot. Both myself and the team spent a lot of time speaking with customers and understanding what are the top questions that they have. Like, we touch on a lot of them. How do you explain the ROI of a data team? What is a data product manager, and how do I know if I need it? So there's topics kind of beyond data observability on our blog, which I really recommend checking out. In various areas related to, you know, the hottest topics like data mesh or data governance. Do you hate it or love it? I don't know. Check out a blog and let me know. And then, you know, folks are also very welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn personally and kind of find me in chat. Mm-hmm. We also released a book, an O'Reilly book, Fundamentals of Data Quality, which has some great sort of, you know, introduction ideas for what data observability is, also how to implement it in practice, and also some case studies, real world case studies. Yeah. Folks from Slack and Uber share their experiences there. So it's a great read.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And the last question, the most important one, why does Monte Carlo come Monte Carlo? Do you use any simulation?
Great question. We're big fans of you know, the Monte Carlo Formula One race. I don't know if you watch a Netflix series about Formula One. Okay, yeah. We all have Formula One hats. No, I'm kidding. That's not the original. But, you know, with the rise of Formula One in recent years, we've all come become really excited about that. So, you know, my experience sort of as a, you know, learn stats and math. And when we started the company very early on, we actually were working with customers really quickly. We were working with customers before we even had a name for the company. And so I was like, we have a really short amount of time. We need to come up with an idea. And, you know, I was in our office and I opened up my stats book and sort of walk through, and like the first option was like Bayes theorem, and I was like, it's like a difficult name for a company. And the second was like Markov chains, and that was not going to work either. And so then I saw Monte Carlo, like Monte Carlo simulations, and I, you know, worked with Monte Carlo simulations and sort of did research on that during my time at Stanford earlier. And so I was like, okay, that's like a relatable name.
Yeah,
people in data get it. Mm-hmm. And we just went with that.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really cool story. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you, Bar, and thank you so much for coming to the Data Scientist Show.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.